7BR Part Heard. Hello and welcome to 7BR's Part Heard, the podcast that traverses the legal landscape, examining issues across multiple practice areas, guided by the diverse expertise of our members. This week, we're discussing the recent consultation on the risk of harm to children and parents in private law children cases and the proposed reforms born out of that work. In May 2019, the Ministry of Justice announced a public call for evidence, steered by a panel of experts, to gather evidence on how the family court protects children and parents in private law children cases involving domestic abuse. The Ministry of Justice also commissioned Dr. Adrienne Barnett to undertake a review of the literature in order to aid in the panel's research. And we are delighted that Dr. Barnett is able to join us on the podcast today, along with Justin Slater, a barrister here at 7BR. Dr. Barnett is a senior lecturer in law at Brunel University London, but previously practiced as a barrister for over 30 years, specialising in family law. Her specialist area of research is domestic abuse in private family law cases, on which she has published widely over the last 20 years. She has undertaken significant research into the implementation of Practice Direction 12J and has delivered training for the judiciary and professionals on child arrangements and domestic abuse. Justin Slater practices as a trial advocate within the full spectrum of child law, from complex private law disputes, including cases with a jurisdictional element, such as relocation cases, through to public law matters where the children are separately represented and where issues involving the Hague Convention and Brussels II Revised are relevant. His particular expertise lies within public law care and adoption proceedings, where he receives instructions from public authorities and lay parties alike. Adrienne and Justin, thank you for joining me. Adrienne, I was wondering if you could speak a bit about the literature review for the benefit of those who haven't yet had the opportunity to read it, why it was commissioned, its scope and the like.
Okay, so some listeners may recall that in May 2019, the Ministry of Justice launched a call for evidence, which was steered by a panel of experts from across family justice, to gather evidence on how the family courts protect children and parents in private law children cases that involve domestic abuse and other serious offences. So to assist the inquiry, the Ministry of Justice commissioned me to undertake a review of the available literature on the risks to children and parents involved in private law children act cases of domestic abuse and how these risks are managed by the family court. So the topics for consideration and the methodology were formulated in consultation with the academic members of the panel of experts. And these were formulated into three broad topics, which were then subdivided into further topics. And the three broad themes were children's and parents' experiences of domestic abuse, both before and after parental separation, children's and parents' experiences of family court proceedings and decision-making in the context of domestic abuse, and then how the family courts respond to and manage domestic abuse in private law children cases, including how they apply Practice Direction 12J and how they manage abusive litigation. Because of the very short, limited timeframe for the review, I basically had 5 weeks from the last week of July to the end of August, I used a rapid evidence assessment approach. This involved searching various academic databases and electronic sources for, first of all, existing literature reviews, because that enables a wealth of studies to be included, which otherwise wouldn't be. And also for studies, original studies conducted primarily in England and Wales. But I broadened it out to other common law jurisdictions if there were gaps in the England and Wales literature or insufficient information. And these searches produced a total of 87 publications for review. To meet quality assurance, I searched only for peer-reviewed literature and also for practice-based research undertaken by or with academic researchers for nationally and internationally recognised organisations, such as the Ministry of Justice, Law Chancellor's Department, the Home Office, the EU, and so on. You can find the summaries of all the studies, of the methodologies of all the studies, in Appendix A of the literature review. And I should also mention that the review was reviewed by two anonymous academic referees and also by senior Ministry of Justice research staff.
A significant theme that emerges in the literature review is this promotion of ongoing relationships between children and both their parents following separation, even in circumstances of domestic abuse. Justin, perhaps you could explain the statutory presumption of parental involvement and what that looks like in practice.
Thanks, Eleanor. And firstly, can I say thank you for Adrienne for the work that I've read now. And I found it as a practitioner to be a real eye opener, actually, and something I'd heartily recommend people do need to read. In terms of the presumption of contact, amendments to the Children Act, which is the main act which covers access to children and where issues of children arise in the court, came in 2014, so some time ago now. And what it said was that there is now a legal presumption that parents' involvement in a child's life will further that child's welfare. Not in all cases, of course, but what the courts now consider is that it is better to have some involvement with both your parents than not to. I think when it came in initially, there were concerns that there would be a very significant shift in terms of how the courts approached Children Act disputes. Certainly, the Act makes it clear that there was never going to be a presumption of equal amount of time spent with the child. So that, again, was one of the very considerable concerns that people had. It doesn't do that at all. It just says that there should be some involvement, and that could be, of course, down to telephone calls or other forms of indirect contact. I think, looking back, I would always advise clients that, you know, the longer they stay in proceedings requesting access, requesting some relationship with a child, provided they don't put a foot wrong in the litigation, provided there aren't very significant concerns about safety, they will get to where they want to get. So quite often with a client, it's a question of persuading them that, you know, it can be a long course, but if you stay the course, you'll get to where you want to be. And I don't think this legal presumption changed that. But what I do think has happened is that there has been a shift away from what the applicant is asking for. And there's a shift now on to how the respondent reacts to that. In other words, the question always in the minds of professionals and judges is really, why shouldn't there be contact? And I think it's a subtle question, a shift of emphasis, but nevertheless, it is significant. And of course, that's the same act that brought in new language. So we have lives with orders and spends time with orders. These are important changes. We've dropped residence and contact now, although they're still widely used by lay people who come to court, and we all know what they mean. But I think where you change the language, you do change people's the way they do business. And it's important. I think there've been some very important changes, some very good changes to make absent parents more feel more included, feel more invested in the life of their child, which of course is generally only to the good of the child. Of course, in the context of domestic abuse, that is a presumption which can be rebutted. And I think we'll probably discuss the practice direction 12J, which is a very significant part of the toolkit for practitioners and really the armory for the court. But that can be rebutted on the basis of any suggestion of domestic abuse.
Adrienne, Justin then mentioned this subtle shift of emphasis, and the literature review refers to a de facto presumption of contact. So I was wondering if you could explain what that is, where that's come from, and in what way has it led, as the review suggests, to domestic abuse being marginalised within private law children proceedings?
Yes. So there's a lot of literature and scholarly research on that looks at how, since the late 1970s, family policy, legal decision-making, professional practice in family proceedings, in private family proceedings, very different in public law, has been shaped by the strong assumption that children need contact with non-resident fathers for their emotional, their psychological, their developmental health. It's probably worth mentioning that behind this assumption, you can find a large body of very contingent, contradictory, ambiguous research, clinical findings and literature, which in fact reveals no firm conclusions on how children's welfare is best served after parental separation. Nevertheless, this assumption has led to what has been described as a de facto presumption of contact. In other words, not a statutory presumption, but a in practice presumption. And you can see this in numerous court judgments where, for example, higher courts repeatedly emphasize that cogent or compelling reasons are required to refuse contact. The court shouldn't give up on contact. And to quote a judge from a case called J.M., contact should be terminated only in exceptional circumstances where there are cogent reasons for doing so, as a last resort, where there's no alternative and only if contact will be detrimental to the child's welfare. And there are very many similar judgments. Now, numerous socio-legal studies have identified how this strong de facto presumption has led to domestic abuse being marginalised within private law children proceedings, which may conflict with a focus on protecting children from harm. And it is an entirely different approach from other legal spheres, for example, the criminal sphere or the public law sphere. But the way in which this presumption could lead courts to minimise domestic abuse and to unsafe contact orders was first revealed by a pioneering study by Marianne Hester and Lorraine Radford, published in 1996, and their findings were confirmed in subsequent research. And it was this research which led to strenuous attempts by policymakers, such as the Children Act Subcommittee of the Lord Chancellor's Advisory Board on Family Law, and also the Court of Appeal, in the seminal case of Riel, but in some earlier cases as well, to bring about a fundamental change in the way judges and professionals respond to domestic abuse. However, subsequent research found that the Riel guidelines were, what they said, more honoured in the breach than the observance, weren't being followed. And this led the Family Justice Council, who did a large piece of research in 2007, to call for a cultural change, with a move away from contact is always the appropriate way forward to contact that is safe and positive for the child is always the appropriate way forward. And it's this study by the Family Justice Council that led to Practice Direction 12J being issued in 2008. Now, studies undertaken in the subsequent 12 years since then have revealed that judges, lawyers, child welfare professionals continue to effectively bend over backwards to achieve contact, even in cases of proven domestic abuse. In fact, PD12J has been revised twice since 2008. Firstly, to implement some of the recommendations of a report that Professor Rosemary Hunter and I did for the Family Justice Council, published in 2013. Then again in 2017, after concerns were raised by Women's AIDS 19 Child Homicides Report. But it would seem that, you know, these revisions don't seem to have led to any real change in the pro-contact culture and the marginalisation of domestic abuse. And the substantial evidence heard by the experts panel for the MOJ inquiry suggests that it may be getting even stricter still.
The review details some of the benefits of children's participation in decision-making processes, but in what is described as a pervasive theme in the review that emerges from the literature is this selective approach that's taken with regard to children's views by courts and professionals based on whether those views accord with this prevailing pro-contact culture. And I was wondering what that selective approach looks like in practice, Adrienne.
Okay, so the selective approach to children's views, what that effectively means is that children's views were found to be taken seriously and could even be determinative of outcomes if children wanted contact with non-resident fathers, but were more likely to be disregarded, to be discounted, or to be treated as problematic if they're opposed to contact, even if children had experienced domestic abuse. And studies have found that where children perhaps voiced reluctance or were opposed to contact, considerable efforts were made to persuade them to have contact or to increase the amount of contact. One of the important studies is Gillian McDonald's study, published in 2017, although her research was undertaken slightly before 2008. And she analyzed a large sample of CAFCAS Section 7 reports. And she found that the way that children's views were presented in the reports, the weight that they attached to those views, and the extent to which their views influenced the recommendations in the report were strongly affected by whether or not the child wanted contact. If children voiced preferences for contact, this was presented in reports as straightforward, unproblematic, and positively influential, and were never challenged on the basis that they might be harmful to the child's welfare. On the other hand, if children were opposed to contact, this was routinely treated in reports as problematic and obstructive, even if children expressed fear of the non-resident parent. She found that children's accounts of abuse were minimized or even disregarded in report recommendations. And there was a sort of emphasis across the whole sample on preserving or promoting parent-child relationships. I think it may be worth mentioning what the research says about what children do want in terms of their participation. The two important studies, one by Stephanie Holt and the other an Australian study by Cashmore, which found children had positive benefits if they were listened to and if decisions were taken on their behalf that reflected their viewpoints, but without the burden of decision-making power. If there is time, I've got a short quote here from a child interviewed by Stephanie Holt, an 11-year-old. And this is what she said. She said, "Them, the contact center, making the decision that it wasn't safe for me to see my dad made it easier for me. I knew that they weren't just listening to me, that they had actually heard me, and that made me feel very safe. I'm not sure I could have made that decision myself. I don't think I should have to."
And Justin, is this kind of selectivity something that you've witnessed in practice?
I think it's a really fascinating element of the report, and I don't think it's something which you can have a knee-jerk reaction to. I think it's something that the Ministry of Justice is going to have to consider very hard. I think the courts are getting much better at listening. Where the hearing element comes in, I think that's not borne out, perhaps, by the evidence that you've just heard. Certainly, courts, judges are far more willing to listen to children, to meet with children, but we are all very clear that that isn't for the purpose of the judge being persuaded by the child. It's simply a mechanism whereby the child can literally tell the judge what they want, what they're doing in their lives. It seems that we do have in the child of an appropriate age and understanding, of course, a witness to what's been going on in the home. And children do pick up on matters. So we have a potentially incredibly important piece of evidence coming from the child. I think the difficulty is, as is always the case, and it's very difficult to see how you can change this, is that that voice is filtered through, firstly, the parents, then perhaps the CAFCAS officer. Sometimes in serious cases, you might have a psychologist. We used to even have veracity evidence. I think that's not so much the case now. But by the time it gets to the judge, it's been selected and it's been cut and paste according to which argument wants to be put. I think things are taking steps in the right direction, but nevertheless, I do find what the doctor just told us to be compelling.
One of the other really compelling parts of the review, to me at least, was the examination of the experiences and views of survivors and their views of family court proceedings, which notes that a common theme was disbelief expressed by courts and professionals, including their own lawyers, with women raising concerns about domestic abuse. And one woman in the review being quoted as saying, "I didn't feel my barrister believed me." She said, "So much of it is uncorroborated." And I wonder, Justin, why you think that might be. Is it because barristers are, to a degree necessarily, focused on the evidential perspective? And how do practitioners ensure that in doing their job, they don't invalidate the lived experiences of their clients?
I think it's always sad when you hear quotes like that. Of course, it's not really council's job to believe anybody. It's council's job to put the most effective case. But you can understand the sentiment, I think, of what's being put there is that an individual, male or female, has gone into court and hasn't felt like they've really been a part of the process. And I think if they don't feel they're a part of the process in something which is, it's as intangible sometimes as the evidence around domestic abuse, you're not really going to get to the bottom of the issue there. I don't think you're ever going to get a clear picture of what's been going on. As to why it happens, I hope it happens in the minority of cases, but you know, barristers, for one, will generally now only see their client for the first time at a hearing. We can't shy away from the fact that's because of legal cuts. I mean, you know, very rare to have legal aid conferences these days. Court time is very short, so counsel will want to get right to the heart of what counsel perceives to be the issue, and sometimes it isn't. Counsel is evidence led. You know, what can I prove? What can they prove? What do I need to put in front of the judge? Court listings are, I think, universally terrible these days. There isn't the time. Judges are district bench or circuit bench are completely overwhelmed by the amount of work that there is. I can only assume that's a similar case in the magistrates' court. Also, we have to remember that counsel know, generally speaking, know the judges, and they know what the judges are going to be interested in. Of course, if you get a judiciary which is very interested in domestic abuse and the nuances there, that will filter down to counsel, because it has to. If they're to do their job properly, if they're to persuade, which is what we're there to do, then things will change that way. I've actually found in my experience that when fact findings do take place, and I think this is borne out by the research that we're discussing, it is actually quite provable. Even in situations where you have very little, as it were, objective third-party evidence, judges are, I think, increasingly better trained, and they are more open to make findings where previously you might think, well, really, what was the evidence for this? So we are, I would say, moving in the right direction, but there are some fundamental blockages along the way, which hopefully will be moved in time.
Justin there touched upon fact-finding hearings, Adrienne, and the review says that while allegations of domestic abuse are made in over 50% of private law children cases, fact-finding hearings are held in less than 10%. So what does this reluctance to hold them tell us about judges and professionals' understandings of domestic abuse and the nuances in the ways that perhaps it can present?
Yes, that was really interesting and fascinating to hear what's currently happening from justice. Now, of course, we have to go back to Practice Direction 12J and paragraph 5 and another paragraph says that courts have to consider the nature of any allegation or admission or evidence of domestic abuse. And here's the important part, and the extent to which it would be likely to be relevant in deciding whether to make a child arrangements order, and if so, on what terms. So this is the key, the extent to which judges and professionals consider domestic abuse to be relevant. And that depends very much on how they understand domestic abuse. So that's the key to it here, really. Now, both the pre and the post Practice Direction 12J research found that judges and particularly legal professionals tended to adopt a rather narrow, legalistic, incident-based understanding of domestic abuse, you know, which is focused on discrete incidents of physical violence, rather like assaults on strangers, and were less able to recognize patterns of coercion and control. And then also with only physical violence being seen as a barrier to contact. However, what was interesting is that a small-scale study I did prior to 2014 and a more recent study by Joe Harwood found that judges and professionals have gained a greater theoretical understanding of domestic abuse, more able to recognize its power and control dynamics. But these broad theoretical insights don't necessarily translate into practice. While they will talk about them, if given a case scenario, it tends to revert back to the physical incident model, and still tend to see only recent severe physical violence as being relevant to contact. And in particular, domestic abuse was tended to be seen as irrelevant if it was considered, say, too old or historic. The problem here is that, you know, domestic abuse has to be understood in the historic abuse, has to be understood in the context of patterns of coercive controlling behavior, in which it continues to have a terrorizing effect. And it's this idea, you know, that normal life continues for a family in between incidents, which is so unrealistic and which doesn't really reflect victims' lived experiences, who talk about continuously walking on eggshells, having to work at preventing further abuse, although very often that's not successful. So it's not then surprising, with that understanding of what domestic abuse is, how it is relevant, that fact-finding hearings are usually only restricted to allegations involving incidents of recent very severe physical violence. So that's an issue. If I could just go on to look at what some of the systemic barriers are to proving the abuse. The physical incident model is compounded by the use of SCOT schedules, you know, where victims have to itemize incidents of violence in a sort of disaggregated and decontextualized way, and in particular the limiting by some judges of the number of incidents in the schedule. The burden of proof, you know, of allegations perhaps not being believed, which is a big issue, is this idea that the mothers make false allegations of domestic abuse. And this is sort of suspicion and disbelief, and also the inability of courts and professionals to understand the effects of domestic abuse on victims and understand their coping strategies. Coping strategies can involve, you know, dissociating themselves from the abuse, forgetting about the abuse, retaining very sketchy memories, and then they are expected to present a sort of coherent narrative and are considered not credible if they can't present a coherent narrative. And then there's, of course, also the sort of stereotypic images of typical victims and victim behavior, which can compound the difficulties of proving abuse. You know, a barrister I'd interviewed for my study gave an example of a case where the judge found that the mother had been fabricating the allegations because she was a solicitor, very well dressed, and came across very well. However, in line with what Justin has said, and despite these barriers, where fact-finding hearings are held, research that is both case file analyses and qualitative studies found that the most likely outcomes are for some or all of the allegations to be found proved.
I suppose one practical example of those sorts of patterns of coercion and control is something you mentioned earlier, this idea of abusive litigation. And I was wondering, Adrienne, if you could explain what that is.
Yes. Perhaps it might help to start off with a quote from Lady Hale in an article she published in Family Law called The View from Court 45 back in 1999. And she said, "The most troubling aspect of my perception is that some women are being pursued and oppressed by controlling or vengeful men with the full support of the system." Now, what does that look like? There are numerous research studies which show how perpetrators of domestic abuse may use continuous litigation as part of a sort of ongoing pattern of control and harassment. And this could involve numerous applications to the family courts, multiple applications to vary orders, requests for adjournments, numerous appeals against orders, complaints against judges, and repeated requests for assessments of mothers and children. And there are some studies which have graphically shown how many mothers have found these tactics and these protracted proceedings as being as bad as or worse than the abuse itself. However, the studies found that, in fact, it's very rare for perpetrators to be identified as vexatious litigants, which may point to a sort of gap in the family court's understanding of the strategy of harassment and control. Now, the Harm Panel have recommended that Section 91.14 should be amended. Perhaps I could go on back to that a little later if Justin is going to explain what Section 91.14 is.
Yeah, I was going to ask Justin, because the courts can, in theory, restrict the ability of litigants to continue litigation by way of barring orders under Section 91.14. But what are some of the problems with that in practice?
I think 91.14 orders are incredibly useful. They're the sort of order that I always refer to them as being the sort of order where you know it when you see it. It's quite difficult, though, to set out immediately what would constitute a need for a 91.14 order. I think that's where an experienced advocate, of course, will assist, and where funding issues, so you have multiple now parties on both sides appearing without advocates, of course, they won't know about this. And for a judge to raise it in and of herself when it's a discretionary relief, I think is sometimes problematic. They are helpful in terms of they can be without limitation, but that is incredibly rare. And they are rare orders in themselves. They can sometimes, I think you can argue for conditions to be put on them. Ordinarily, you're looking, I think, probably at a 1 to 2 year period, a sort of cooling off period. That's where I've more normally seen them. I think that the interesting point, though, in relation to domestic abuse is this, that they are seen to restrict litigation. There's almost a sense in which they prevent the court being burdened with numerous applications without the applicant requesting permission to bring that litigation. I think what this research tells us is that actually it's the bringing of the litigation is not only a burden to the court, and judges are very receptive to that, but it's also a part of this pattern of post-separation abuse. It's a part of the abuse cycle. And I think actually that is very rarely put by advocates. I think, speaking frankly, it would be more difficult to get that angle past a court, because don't forget, the courts have front and center of their considerations that they don't want to be riding roughshod over Article 6, Article 8 right to family life, right just to come to court to ask a question. That goes very much against the grain when you're talking about applications that are available to individuals to take in relation to their children, and they have no other way of making progress on issues other than making applications. So there is a hesitancy there. I think what's interesting is that we ought perhaps to be seeing the need for 91.14 orders, so a need to prohibit further applications without permission from the judge, because it is a part of this cycle of continuing abuse. It may actually have very little to do with the child. It may be all to do with an individual getting back in some way against their ex-partner.
And Adrienne, you mentioned that one of the recommendations of the Harm Panel report was to reverse the exceptionality requirement of Section 91.14. In what way would that assist those subjected to vexatious litigation?
What the Harm Panel have recommended is that in order to enable Section 91.14 to be more effective in protecting children and adult victims, a number of measures should be included in the Domestic Abuse Bill, which is currently going before through Parliament, to reverse the exceptionality requirement, the requirement that has to stem from the case law in applying Section 91.14, that it should only be, such orders should only be made in exceptional circumstances. So what is recommended is that these measures for the bill should ensure that, first of all, the orders are made where it is in the best interests of the child to make such an order. They may be made where the court concludes that the bringing or prolonging of proceedings constitutes domestic abuse against the other parent, that it's not necessary to demonstrate repeat applications before an order can be made, that the court could make an order of its own motion, and then subsequently that leave to apply for a child arrangements order after Section 9114 order has been made should only be granted where the applicant provides evidence to show that circumstances have materially changed and where the grant of leave wouldn't create a risk of harm to the child or the other parent. And then it recommends that the child arrangements programme should include a procedure for courts to determine if an application is being made abusively.
Looking forward then, the Ministry of Justice has set out its implementation plan. What does that include, Adrienne?
Right. So the Ministry of Justice implementation plan is based on the Harm Panel report, which identified, together with the literature review, which identified four overarching barriers to the court responding consistently and effectively to domestic abuse. Firstly, the pro-contact culture. Secondly, the adversarial system. Thirdly, significant resource limitations across all aspects of proceedings. And fourthly, the way the court works in a silo, compartmentalized, and doesn't have coordination with other courts and other organizations. So the main aspects of the implementation plan are, firstly, a statement of practice for cases involving domestic abuse or other risks of harm, based on the panel's recommended design principles. Now, these design principles are, firstly, a culture of safety, an investigative and problem-solving approach, sufficient resources, and a more coordinated approach between different parts of the system. So that's the first aspect of the implementation plan. Secondly, there's going to be a review of the presumption of parental involvement. Thirdly, they're going to pilot integrated domestic abuse courts, and in particular, some really good models from the United States, which use a trauma-informed approach to domestic integrated courts. They're going to trial various options to enhance the voice of the child and assess methods of child engagement. They are going to include various amendments to the Domestic Abuse Bill, in particular prohibiting cross-examination of victims by perpetrators and alleged perpetrators, which is formally missing from the bill, and enable victims to be automatically eligible for special measures. They're going to trial improved guidance and training across the family justice system for all judges and professionals. They're going to be working on an accreditation scheme for those who will be providing assessments and reports to the court. They're going to monitor private law proceedings and increase investment in the family justice system. But I think one of the interesting things, which I want to just mention in a couple of lines in a bit more depth, is piloting an investigative approach. Now, this is going to involve a three-phase approach, which was recommended by the Harm Panel. Firstly, an initial investigation and information exchange phase. This focused on understanding what has been happening for the child, including the impact of any abuse within the family, and then them and the adult victims' needs to be protected from future harm. So information will be gathered proactively by the court, drawing on all relevant sources, consulting parents and children, etc. If no agreement is reached at this point, then the case would be proactively prepared for adjudication. You then have the adjudication phase, which would be a judge-led process focused on accurately identifying any risk of harm and then coordinating with other justice processes. If facts need to be determined to assess risk, then these will be take place at this stage. And then finally, a follow-up stage. So a proactive follow-up 3 to 6 months after orders have made to see how they're working. Again, it would be non-adversarial, but if there's need for further adjudication, then it would follow the investigation and adjudication process again.
Finally, Justin, underpinning a lot of this plan, as Adrienne just outlined, are these design principles which promote an investigative approach and a culture of safety within the family justice system. Do you have hope that this is possible?
Always have hope. Interesting to listen about what some of the solutions might be to this issue. I've always been very impressed by the FDAC, the Family Drug and Alcohol Courts. They have time. They have repeated hearings. There's continuity, not only of judiciary, but also of the professionals working with the family. But I don't know whether repeatedly coming to court is actually what a victim of domestic abuse would necessarily need. I think there are issues there. Principally, I think that the biggest step that can be taken is education. I think the judiciary are ahead of the bar in terms of that. If you hear Practice Direction 12F referred to in court, it's usually by a judge, and that really has all the tools that we need to deal with these issues contained in it. I think the other issue, of course, is more court time, not necessarily for repeated hearings, but for an emphasis on if there is an issue here that needs to be looked at, we will find time to get to the bottom of it. And I think if practitioners were satisfied that that was an option, I think you would find that domestic abuse would be far more fully investigated.
Adrienne and Justin, thank you very much for talking to me.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of 7BR's Part Heard. For more information, including links to the Harm Panel report and Dr. Barnett's literature review, please visit our website.